basement of the building, and had brought all of his possessions up to the second floor. The front rooms and hallway of the house were full of furniture, chairs and desks stacked on tables and couches. Various electronics, saved from the flood, were now resting on the dining room table. It looked like a haphazard estate sale. The damage to the house was extensive, but not irreparable. Zaytoun knew the basement would be a loss, and might not be habitable for some time. But the first and second floors hadn't been badly harmed, and this gave Zaytoun comfort. There was a lot of dirt, mud, grime, much of it from Todd moving things upstairs and rushing in and out of the house. But the damage could have been far worse. Zaytoun learned from Todd that because the house's phone box was above the water line, the landline was still working. He immediately dialed Kathy's cell phone.
"Hello? I'm here," he said.
She almost screamed. She hadn't realized how worried she'd been.
"Alhamdulillah," she said. Arabic for praise be to God.
"Now get out!" He told her he wouldn't be leaving. He told her about the woman in the ballooning dress in the foyer, how he'd lifted the ladder to save her. He told her about the fisherman and Frank and the two elderly couples. He was talking so fast, she laughed.
"So when do you plan to leave?" she asked.
"I don't," he said.
He tried to explain. If he left, what would he do? He would be in a home full of women with nothing to occupy himself. He would eat, watch TV, and be left to worry from afar. Here, in the city, he could stay and monitor developments. He could help where needed. They had a half dozen properties to look after, he reminded her. He was safe. He had food. He could take care of himself and prevent further damage.
"Really, I want to see this," he said.
He wanted to see everything that had happened, and would happen with his own eyes. He cared about this city, and believed in his heart he could be of use.
"So you feel safe?" she asked.
"Of course," he said. "This is good."
Kathy knew that she couldn't dissuade him. But how would she explain to her children, as they watched images of the city drowning, that their father was there by choice, paddling around in a second-hand canoe? She tried to reason with him, noting that the TV reports were saying that things were only getting worse, that the water would soon become infected with all manner of pollutants, oil, garbage, animal remains, and that diseases would soon follow. Zaytoun promised to be careful. He promised to call back at noon the next day from the house on Claiborne.
"Call every day at noon," she said.
He said he would.
"You better," she said.
They hung up. Kathy turned on the television. The news led with reports of lawlessness and death. The media consensus was that New Orleans had descended into a third-world state. Sometimes this comparison was made with regard to the conditions, where hospitals were not open or working, where clean water and other basic services weren't available. In other instances, the words were spoken over images of African-American residents wilting in the heat outside the Montreal Convention Center, or standing on rooftops waving for help. There were unverified reports of roving gangs of armed men, of guns being fired at helicopters trying to rescue patients from the roof of a hospital. Residents were being referred to as refugees. Kathy was certain Zaytoun was unaware of the level of danger being reported. He may have felt safe where he was in Uptown, but what if there really was chaos, and that chaos was simply making its way to him? She was reluctant to believe the hyperbolic and racially charged news coverage, but still, things were devolving. Most of those left in the city were trying desperately to get out. She couldn't stand it. She called the house on Claiborne again. No answer. He was already gone.
Zaytoun and Frank were paddling back to Zaytoun's house on Dart Street. As they made their way home, passing a half dozen fanboats along the way, it occurred to Zaytoun that he and Frank had heard the people they had helped, in particular the old woman floating inside her home, because they were in a canoe. Had they been in a fanboat, the noise overwhelming, they would have heard nothing. They would have passed by, and the woman likely would not have survived another night. It was the very nature of this small, silent craft that allowed them to hear the quietest cries. The canoe was good. The silence was crucial. Zaytoun dropped Frank at his house and made for home. His paddle kissed the clean water, his shoulders worked in perfect rhythm. Zaytoun had traveled 5-6 miles already that day, and he wasn't tired. Night was falling, and he knew he had to be home, safe on his roof. But he was sorry to see the day end. He tied the canoe to the back porch and climbed up into the house. He retrieved a portable grill and brought it to the roof. He made a small fire and cooked chicken breasts and vegetables he'd thawed that day. The night fell as he ate, and soon the sky was darker than any he'd known in New Orleans. The sole light came from a helicopter circling downtown, looking tiny and powerless in the distance. Using bottled water, Zaytoun cleaned up and prayed on the roof. He crawled into the tent, his body aching, but his mind alive, playing back the events of the day. He and Frank really had saved that woman, hadn't they? They had. It was a fact. They'd brought 4 others to safety, too. And there would be more to do tomorrow. How could he explain to Kathy, to his brother Ahmed, that he was so thankful he'd stayed in the city? He was certain he had been called to stay, that God knew he would be of service if he remained. His choice to stay in the city had been God's will. Too excited to sleep, he went back through the window and into the house. He wanted to find the photo of Muhammad again. He'd forgotten who was with him in the picture. Was it Ahmed? And he wanted to see the expression on Muhammad's face, that world-conquering smile. He retrieved the box of pictures, and while looking for that one, he found another. He'd forgotten about this photo. There he was, Muhammad with the vice president of Lebanon. Zaytoun hadn't seen the image for a few years. Muhammad wasn't even 20, and he'd won a race starting in Saida and ending in Beirut, a distance of 26 miles. The crowd was stunned. He'd come out of nowhere, Muhammad Zaytoun, a sailor's son from the tiny island of Arwad, and stunned everyone with his strength and endurance. Zaytoun knew his father Mahmoud was somewhere in the crowd. He never missed a race. But it hadn't always been so. Mahmoud wanted Muhammad and all of his sons working on dry land, so Muhammad spent his early teenage years as a craftsman, laying brick and apprenticing for an ironsmith. He was a powerfully built young man and was finished with school at 14. At 18, he looked much older, with a full mustache and a square jaw. He was both a workhorse and a charmer, admired equally by his elders and the young women in town. With his father's grudging approval, Muhammad crewed on local fishing boats in the afternoons and evenings, and even at 14, after a full day of fishing miles from land, Muhammad insisted on swimming to shore. The other fishermen would have barely pulled in the last net when they would hear a splash and see Muhammad cutting through the sea, racing them to the beach. Muhammad didn't tell his father about such endeavors, and he certainly didn't tell him when, a few years later, he decided that he was destined to be the world's greatest long-distance swimmer. It was 1958. Egypt and Syria, reacting to a number of political factors, including growing American influence in the region, merged, creating the United Arab Republic. The Union was meant to create a more powerful bloc,
one that might grow to include Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and others. There was wide public support for the alliance, pride bursting from the streets and windows of Syria and Egypt, the citizens of both countries seeing the union as a step along the way to a broader alignment between the Arab states. There were parades and celebrations from Alexandria to Latakia. One of the commemorative events was a race between Jableh and Latakia, in which swimmers from all over the Arab world would swim 30 kilometers through the Mediterranean. It was the first race of its kind on the Syrian coast, and 18-year-old Mohammed followed every step from the preparations to the race itself. He watched the swimmers train, studying their strokes and regimen, longing to be part of it himself. He managed to be appointed to the crew of the guideboat for one of the competitors, Munir Deeb, which would keep pace with him along the race's route. Along the way, unable to contain himself, Mohammed jumped in and swam alongside Deeb and the other contestants. He not only kept up with the professionals, he impressed one of the judges. "That boy is great," the judge said. "He's going to be a champion." From that day on, Mohammed thought of little else but the fulfillment of that prophecy. Still only 18 years old, he worked mornings as a mason and ironsmith, afternoons as a fisherman, and at night he began to train for the next year's race. He kept his training secret from his father, even when he undertook two long-distance tests, one between Latakia and Jableh, and another between Jableh and Banias. Soon enough, though, Mahmud learned of his son's aspirations, and fearing he would lose his son to the unforgiving sea that had almost taken his own life, he forbade him from swimming long distances. He wanted him out of fishing, away from the sea. He wanted his son alive. But Mohammed could not stop. As difficult as it was to disobey his father, he continued to train. Telling no one in his family, Mohammed entered the next year's race. As he stepped out of the water in Latakia, the cheers were deafening. He had won handily. Before Mohammed could return home, an old friend of Mahmoud's, himself a champion swimmer, visited the Zaytun house, congratulating Mahmud on his son's victory. This is how Mahmud learned that Mohammed Zaytun was the best swimmer in all of Syria. By the time Mohammed arrived home that night, Mahmud had given up his resistance. If his son wanted this, and if his son was destined to swim, if God had made him a swimmer, then Mahmud could not stand in the way. He bought Mohammed a bus ticket to Damascus to train and compete with the best swimmers in the region. Zaytun found another photo. Mohammed's first major victory came in that same year, 1959, in a race in Lebanon. The field was crowded, filled with well-known names, but Mohammed not only finished first, he did so in record time, 9 hours and 55 minutes. This photo, Zaytun was almost sure, was taken during the celebration afterward. Thousands were there, applauding his brother. How old was Zaytun at the time? He did the calculations in his head. Just a year. He was maybe 1 year old. He remembered nothing of those early wins. The next year, Mohammed entered the famed race between Capri and Naples, a contest that attracted the best swimmers in the world. The favorite was Alfredo Camarero, an Argentinian, who'd placed first or second in the race 5 years running. Mohammed was an unknown when the race began at 6 in the morning, and after 8 hours, when he was approaching shore, he had no idea that he was in the lead. It wasn't until he stepped out of the sea, hearing shrieks of surprise and the chanting of his name, that he realized he'd won. "Zaytun the Arab has won," they cheered. No one could believe it. A Syrian winning the world's greatest long-distance competition. Camarero told everyone that Mohammed was the strongest swimmer he had ever seen. Mohammed dedicated the victory to President Nasser. In return, Nasser made the 20-year-old Mohammed an honorary lieutenant in the Navy. The Prince of Kuwait attended the race and celebrated him at an honorary dinner in Naples. The next year,
Muhammad won the Capri to Naples race again, this time breaking the course record set by Camarero by 15 minutes. Muhammad was now, indisputably, the best ocean swimmer in the world. As a boy, Abdulrahman was enthralled, proud beyond measure. To grow up in that house, with a brother like that, to bask every day in the glory he'd brought to the family. His siblings' pride in Muhammad fueled how they felt when they awoke each day, how they walked and talked and were perceived in Jable and Arwad and everywhere across Syria. It changed permanently how they saw the world. Muhammad's accomplishments implied, proved, really, that the Zaytuns were extraordinary. It was incumbent, thereafter, on each and every child to live up to that legacy. It had been 41 years since Muhammad's death. Muhammad's incredible rise and premature passing had shaped the trajectory of Zaytun's family, in general, and of Abdulrahman in particular. But he didn't like to dwell on it. In his less generous moments, he believed his brother had been stolen from him, that the unfairness of taking such a beautiful man so young put many things into question. But he knew he was wrong to think this way, and it was unproductive in any case. All he could do now was honor his brother's memory. Be strong, be brave, be true. Endure. Be as good as Muhammad was. Zaytun tucked himself into the tent and fell into a fitful sleep. All over the neighborhood, the dogs were mad with hunger. Their barking was wild, unmoored, spiraling. Thursday, September 1st. By 6 a.m., Kathy had the Odyssey packed and the kids buckled in. Her sisters were still asleep as she quietly backed out of the driveway, leaving Baton Rouge. It was 1,500 miles to Phoenix. "Are we really leaving Mickey?" Nadima asked. Even Kathy couldn't believe it, but what else could they do? She'd begged Patty to let her leave the dog there for a week. She'd given dog food and money to one of Patty's teenage sons to care for poor Mickey. It was better than putting her in a kennel, and far better than trucking the dog all the way to Phoenix and back. Kathy didn't have the nerves for it. It was hard enough with four kids. They were beginning what would be a 3-day drive, minimum, more likely 4 or 5. What was she doing? It was crazy to drive 4 days in a car full of kids, and making the decision without her husband. It had been so long since she'd been in such a situation, but she had no choice. She couldn't stay in Baton Rouge for however many weeks it would be before New Orleans was habitable again. She hadn't even begun to think about school, about clothes, they'd only packed for 2 days, or about what they would do for money while the business was at a standstill. Heading west on I-10, she felt some measure of relief in knowing that at the very least, on the open road, she would have some time to think. Out on the highway, she dialed the Claiborne house. Though it was hours before their agreed-upon time, she called in case Zaytun had gotten there first and was waiting to call her. The phone rang 3 times. "Hello," a man said. The voice was an American's, not her husband's. It was gruff, impatient. "Is Abdulrahman Zaytun there?" she asked. "What? Who?" She repeated her husband's name. "No, no one here by that name." "Is this 5010 Claiborne?" she asked. "I don't know. I think so," the man said. "Who is this?" she asked. There was a pause. Then the line went dead. Kathy drove for a mile before she could even wrap her mind around what had just happened. Who was that voice? It wasn't one of the tenants. She knew them all. It was a stranger, someone who had found a way into the house and was now answering the phone. Again her mind took quick turns downward. What if the man on the phone had killed her husband and robbed the house and moved in? She pulled into a McDonald's and parked, calming herself down. She turned on the radio and almost immediately came upon a report from New Orleans. She knew she shouldn't listen, but she couldn't help it. The reports of lawlessness were worse than before, and Governor Blanco, in a statement directed to would-be criminals, warned that war-hardened U.S. soldiers were on the way to New Orleans to restore order at any cost. "I have one message for these hoodlums," she said. "These troops know how to shoot and kill, and they are more than willing to do so if necessary, and I expect they will." Kathy knew she should turn the dial before the kids heard any of it, but it was too late. "Did they say the city was flooded, Mama? Is our house underwater? Are they shooting people, Mama?" Kathy turned the radio off. "Please, babies, don't ask me questions." She steeled herself and got back on the highway, determined to drive straight through to Phoenix. She just had to get to Yuko and she would be okay. Yuko would settle her. Of course Zaytoun was okay, she told herself. The man on the phone could have been anyone. There would be nothing unusual about people sharing a phone when most of the city's landlines had ceased to function. For a few minutes she was calm, but the kids started in with the questions again. "What happened to our house, Mama? Where's Daddy?" This got Kathy's mind going again. What if that man was her husband's killer? What if she'd just spoken to the man who had murdered him? She felt as if she'd been watching from above the convergence of forces on her husband. Only she knew what was happening in the city, the madness, the suffering and desperation. He had no television, couldn't know the extent of the chaos. She'd seen the images from helicopters, the press conferences. She'd heard the statistics, the stories of gangs and rampant crime. Kathy bit her lip. "Babies, don't ask me right now. Don't ask me. When are we going home?" "Please," Kathy snapped. "Just leave it alone for a minute. Let me think." She couldn't hold it in anymore. She could barely see the road. The lines were disappearing. She felt it coming on and pulled over. She was blind with tears, wiping her nose with the back of her hand, her head against the steering wheel. "What's wrong, Mama?" The highway flew beside her. In a few minutes, she managed to gather herself enough to pull into a rest stop. She called Yuko. "Don't drive another foot," Yuko said. Within 20 minutes, a plan was shaped. Kathy stayed put, while Yuko's husband, Ahmed, looked into flights. Kathy would only have to make it as far as Houston. Yuko would arrange for Kathy and the kids to spend the night at a friend's house there. Ahmed would fly to Houston immediately, and in the morning he would meet her there and drive the family all the way to Phoenix. "Are you sure?" Kathy asked. "I'm your sister, you're my sister, you're all I have," Yuko said. Her mother, Kamiko, had passed away that year. The loss had been devastating to both Yuko and Kathy. This got Kathy crying all over again. That morning, Zaytoun woke after 9, exhausted from the howling of the dogs. He was determined this day to find them. After his prayers, he paddled out over his flooded yard. The dogs seemed very near. He crossed the street and went left on Dart. Only a few houses down, he found the source. It was a house he knew well. He paddled closer, and the dogs went wild, their desperate sounds coming from within. Now he had to find a way inside. The first story was flooded, so he assumed the dogs, 2 of them, he guessed, were trapped on the second. There was a many-boughed tree near the house. He paddled to it and tied the canoe to the trunk. He lifted himself into the tree, climbing until he could see through a second-story window. He saw no dogs, but he could hear them. They were in that house, and they knew he was close. The tree where he was standing was about 10 feet from the window. He couldn't jump. It was too far. At that moment, he spotted a plank, 1 foot wide and 16 feet long, floating in the side yard. He climbed down, paddled to the plank, brought it to the house, and leaned it against the tree. He climbed up again and lifted the plank to create a bridge between the tree and the roof. He was about 16 feet off the ground, about 8 feet above the waterline. The bridge he created was not so different from the scaffolding he used every day in his work, so after testing it quickly with the weight of 1 foot, he walked across and onto the roof. From there, he pried a window open and ducked into the house. The barking grew louder and more urgent. He walked through the bedroom he'd arrived in, hearing the dogs grow more hysterical. As he strode through the second-floor hallway, he saw them. 2 dogs, a black Labrador, and a smaller mixed breed in a cage. They had no food, and their water dish was empty. They seemed confused enough to bite him, but he didn't hesitate. He opened the cage and let them out. The Labrador ran past him and out of the room. The smaller dog cowered in the cage. Zaytoun stepped back to give him room, but he stayed where he was. For the Labrador, there was nowhere to go. He tried the stairs and saw the water reach to just a few inches below the second floor. He returned to Zaytoun, who had a plan. "Wait here," he told them. He walked back across the plank bridge, climbed down the tree and into his canoe, and paddled back to his house. He climbed up to the roof, slipped through his window, and went down the few steps not underwater. Knowing Kathy kept the freezer stocked with meat and vegetables, he leaned down and removed 2 steaks, quickly closing the door to keep the finite cold from escaping. He walked back up to the roof, grabbed 2 plastic water bottles, and dropped them and the steaks into the canoe below. He shimmied down and returned to the house of the dogs. Again they sensed him approaching, and this time they were both waiting by the window, their heads peeking over the sill. When they smelled the meat, frozen though it was, they began barking wildly, their tails wagging. Zaytoun refilled their water dish, and they dove for it. After drinking their fill, they went to work on the steaks, gnawing on them until the meat thawed. Zaytoun watched for a few minutes, tired and content, until he heard more barking. There were other dogs, and he had a freezer full of food. He went back to his house to prepare. He stacked more meat into his canoe and went in search of the other animals left behind. Almost immediately after leaving his house, he heard a distinct barking, muffled, coming from almost the same location as the dogs he'd just found. He paddled closer, wondering if there was actually a 3rd dog in the home he'd just been in. He anchored the canoe to the tree again, took 2 stakes with him, and climbed up. From the middle bough, he looked this time to the neighboring house, the one on the left, and saw 2 more dogs, jumping against the glass. He pulled the plank away from the 1st house, and arranged it so it extended to the other. The dogs, seeing him coming, went wild, leaping in place. In a moment, he'd opened the window and stepped in, the 2 dogs jumping at him. He dropped the 2 stakes, and the dogs pounced, forgetting about him entirely. He needed to give them water, too, so he again paddled home and brought more water bottles and a bowl back to them. Zaytoun left the window open enough to allow the dogs to get fresh air, then walked across the plank again and climbed down the tree to his canoe. He paddled off, thinking it was about time to call Kathy. As he paddled, he noticed that the water was growing more contaminated. It was darker now, opaque, streaked with oil and gasoline, polluted with debris, food, garbage, clothing, pieces of homes. But Zaytoun was in high spirits. He felt invigorated by what he'd been able to do for the dogs, that he was there for those animals. And 4 dogs that almost certainly would have starved would now live because he had stayed behind, and because he'd bought that old canoe. He couldn't wait to tell Kathy. By noon, he'd returned to the house on Claiborne. Today, Todd was gone, and the house was empty. He went inside and called.
"Oh, thank God," Kathy said. "Thank God, thank God, thank God. Where have you been?"
She and the kids were still driving to Houston. She pulled over. "What are you worried about?" Zaytoun asked.
I said I'd call at noon. It's noon.
Who was that man? She asked.
What man? He asked.
She explained that when she'd called earlier that day, someone else had answered the phone.
This was unsettling to Zaytun. As they spoke, he looked around the house. There was no sign of theft or crime of any kind. There were no broken locks or windows. Maybe the man had been a friend of Todd's. He promised Kathy it was nothing at all to worry about, that he would get to the bottom of it. Kathy, calmer now, was glad to hear that he'd been able to help the dogs, that he was feeling useful. But she didn't want him in New Orleans anymore, no matter how many dogs he was feeding or how many people he was finding and saving. I really want you to leave, she said. The news coming out of the city, it's so bad. There's looting, killing. Something bad is going to happen to you.
Zaytun could hear how worried she was. But he hadn't seen anything like the chaos she described. If it existed at all, and she knew how the media was, it would be downtown. Where he was, he said, it was so quiet, so calm, so otherworldly and strange, that he couldn't possibly be in danger. Maybe, he said, there was a reason he'd stayed, a reason he'd bought that canoe, a reason he was put in this particular situation at this particular time.
I feel like I'm supposed to be here, he said.
Kathy was silent.
It's God's will, he said.
She had no answer to this.
They moved on to practical matters. Her cell phone never worked well at Yuko's house in Phoenix, so she gave Zaytun the landline there. He wrote it down on a piece of paper and left it by the Claiborne phone.
Get the kids into school when you get to Phoenix, he said.
Kathy rolled her eyes.
Of course, she said.
I love you. And them, he said. And they hung up.
He set out again, and immediately saw Charlie Ray, who lived just to the right of the Claiborne house. He was a blue-eyed carpenter in his 50s, a friendly and easygoing native Zaytun had known for years. He was sitting on his porch like today was a day like any other.
You stayed too, Zaytun said.
I guess I did.
You need anything? Water?
Charlie didn't, but said he might soon. Zaytun promised to check in with him again and paddled off, curious about how many people had remained in the city. If Frank stayed and Todd and Charlie had weathered the storm, surely there were tens of thousands more. He wasn't alone in his defiance. He continued on, knowing he should feel tired, but he wasn't at all tired. He had never felt stronger. This day, he ventured closer to downtown, passing families wading through the water, pushing laundry tubs full of their possessions. He paddled by a pair of women pushing an inflatable baby pool, their clothes and food inside. Each time, Zaytun asked if he could help, and occasionally they'd ask for a bottle or two of water. He would hand them whatever he had. He was finding so many things, bottled water, MREs, canned food, and whenever he saw anyone, he gave them whatever was in his canoe. He had plenty for himself at home, and didn't want any more weighing him down. He paddled up to the I-10 ramp at Claiborne and Poydras, a concrete structure about 10 feet above the waterline. Dozens of people were there, waiting for rescue. A helicopter had dropped off water and food, and they seemed to be well-provisioned. They asked Zaytun if he wanted any water, and he said that he had enough, but that he would bring it to those who needed it. They gave him a case. As he turned his canoe around, he saw a half-dozen dogs with the group, most of them puppies. They seemed healthy and well-fed, and were keeping cool from the heat under the shade of the cars. Zaytun, assuming that whatever was ailing the city was likely worse downtown, chose not to get too close to the epicenter. He turned around and made his way back to Dart Street. As Kathy was driving to Houston, Yuko was making arrangements for the family to spend the night with a longtime friend of theirs she called Miss Mary.
Like Yuko and Kathy, Mary was an American, born into a Christian household, who'd converted to Islam as an adult. Now her house had become a sanctuary for families fleeing the storm, and when Kathy's Odyssey pulled into the driveway, there were already a dozen or more people there, all of them Muslims from New Orleans and other parts of Louisiana and Mississippi. Mary, a bright-eyed woman in her 40s, met Kathy and the kids in the driveway. She took their bags and hugged Kathy so tight that Kathy started crying yet again. Mary took them inside and showed the kids the pool and back, and within minutes the four of them were swimming and happy. Kathy collapsed on the couch and tried not to think of anything. When he got back to the house on Dart, Zaytoun found his tent in the water below. It had been blown off the roof, probably Zaytoun guessed by a helicopter. He retrieved it and set it up again, dried the interior with towels, and then went inside the house to look for ballast. He brought out stacks of books, this time the heaviest ones he could find, and put them in the corners of the tent. As he was inside stabilizing it, he heard another helicopter approach. The sound was deafening. He expected it to pass over his house on its way elsewhere, but when he poked his head out and looked up, he saw that it was hovering over his house, over him. Two men inside were signaling to him. He waved them off, trying to indicate that he was fine, but this only seemed to intrigue them more. The second man in the helicopter was beginning to lower a cage to him when Zaytoun thought to give the man a thumbs up. He signaled to his tent and then to himself and gave the helicopter a series of frantic thumbs up and A-OK signals. Finally understanding Zaytoun's intent to stay, one of the men in the helicopter decided to drop a box of water down to him. Zaytoun tried to wave him off again to no avail. The box came down, and Zaytoun leapt out of the way before it knocked the tent flat and sent plastic bottles bouncing everywhere. Satisfied, the helicopter tilted away and was gone. Zaytoun returned to restabilizing his shelter, beginning to get ready for bed. But like the night before, he was restless, his mind racing with the events of the day. He sat on the roof, watching the movement of the helicopter circling and swooping over the rest of the city. He made plans for the following day. He would venture farther toward downtown. He would revisit the I-10 overpass. He would check on the state of their office and warehouse over on Dublin Street. On the first floor there, they kept their extra supplies. Tools, paints, brushes, drop cloths, everything. And on the second floor, they had their offices, with their computers, files, maps, invoices, deeds to the properties. He winced, thinking of what had become of the building, a rickety thing to begin with. All night, the helicopters roamed overhead. Besides them, it was quiet. He heard no dogs. After his prayers, he fell asleep under a vibrating sky. Friday, September 2nd. In the morning, Zaytoun rose early, climbed down to his canoe, and paddled across the street to feed the dogs. They whimpered as he approached, and he took it as relief and gratitude. He climbed the tree, stepped carefully across the plank to the house on the right, and crawled through the window. He dropped two large pieces of steak for the dogs and refilled their water dish. As they busied themselves, he climbed out of the window, stepped carefully over to the next door roof, and made his way into the second house to feed the second pair of dogs. They barked and wagged their tails, and he dropped two pieces of lamb between them and refilled their water. He left through the window, climbed down to his canoe, and paddled off. It was time to see what had become of his office building. It was about a half mile away, just off Carrollton, a nearby road lined with warehouses, chain stores, and gas stations. The water was filthy now, streaked with oil and spotted with detritus. Anyone left to wade through this would become sick, he was sure. But so far this day, he'd seen no one in the water. The city was emptying. Every day there were fewer people waiting, fewer faces in windows, fewer private watercraft like his. It had been drizzling throughout the morning, but now the rain began to pick up. The wind came on, and the day grew miserable. Zaytun paddled into the wind, struggling to control the canoe, the wind rippling the brown-blue water. He took Earhart over to Carrollton, and took Carrollton southwest on his way to Dublin. He expected that there might be people on Carrollton, like Napoleon and St. Charles. It seemed a logical thoroughfare for rescue or military boats. But when he got close, he saw no official personnel at all. Instead, he saw a group of men gathered at the Shell station just across the street from his office. The station was elevated from the main road and was under only a few feet of water. The men, about 8 or 9 of them, were carrying full garbage bags from the station's office and loading them into a boat. It was the first looting he'd seen since the storm, and these men were the first who fit the description of those Cathy had warned him about. This was an organized group of criminal opportunists who weren't simply taking what they needed to survive. They were stealing money and goods from the gas station, and they were operating in numbers that seemed designed to intimidate anyone, like Zaytun, who might see them or try to impede them. Zaytun was far enough away to observe without fear of them reaching him, at least not quickly. Still, he slowed his canoe to keep a safe distance, trying to figure out a way to get to his office without passing directly by them. But one of the men had already noticed him. He was young, wearing long denim shorts and a white tank top. He squared his shoulders to Zaytun and made a point of revealing the handle of a gun he had, holstered in his belt. Zaytun quickly looked away. He didn't want to invite confrontation. He turned his canoe around and made his way toward the house on Claiborne. He wouldn't check on the office this day. He arrived before noon and called Cathy. She was still in Houston at Miss Mary's house.
"Won't be able to check on the office today," he said.
"Why?" she asked.
He didn't want her to worry. He knew he had to lie.
"Rain," he said.
She told him that friends had been calling her, checking in to see where she and Zaytun were, if they were safe. When she told him that her husband was still in the city, there was always a 3-stage response. First, they were shocked. Then they realized it was Zaytun they were talking about, a man who didn't inspire worry in any situation. And finally, they asked that while he was paddling around, would he mind checking on their property? Zaytun was all too happy to be given a mission, and Cathy obliged. She'd just gotten a call from the Bermidians, friends of theirs for 13 years. Ali Bermidian was a professor of computer science at Tulane University and ran the Masjid al-Rahman, a Muslim student association on campus. They had a building on Buth Street that housed a resource center and dorm for visiting students from the Arab world. Delilah Bermidian had just called Cathy, asking if Zaytun could check on the building to see what kind of damage it had sustained. Zaytun said no problem, he would check on it. He knew the building well. He'd been to functions there a few times over the years, and he knew how to get there. He was curious, actually, to see what had become of the campus, given that it was on higher ground. "Call again at noon," she said.
"Of course," Zaytun said.
Before he left, Zaytun called his brother Ahmed. After expressing great relief to hear from him, Ahmed got serious.
"You must leave," Ahmed said.
"No, no, I'm fine. Everything is fine," Zaytun said.
Ahmed tried playing the big brother.
"Go to your family," he said. "I really want you to leave. Your family needs you."
"They need me here more," Zaytun said, trying not to sound too grandiose. "This is my family, too."
Ahmed had no way to counter such a statement.
"This call is expensive," Zaytun said. "I'll call you tomorrow."
When he arrived at Tulane, the water was so low there that he easily stepped from the canoe onto dry land. He walked into the tiled courtyard of the Masjid ar-Rahman and looked around. The grounds were cross-hatched with downed branches, but otherwise the property was undamaged. He was about to look inside when he saw a man emerging from the building's side door.
"Nasser?" he said.
It was Nasser Dayoub, also from Syria. Nasser had left the country in 1995, traveling first to Lebanon. From Beirut, he stowed away on a tanker whose destination he didn't know. It turned out it was heading to the United States, and when it made port, Nasser jumped off and immediately sought asylum. He was eventually granted sanctuary, and by then he'd moved to New Orleans. He'd stayed at the Masjid ar-Rahman during his legal proceedings.
Abdulrahman?
They shook hands and exchanged stories of what they'd been doing since the storm. Nasser's home, in the Broadmoor neighborhood adjacent to Uptown, had been flooded, and he'd come to the Student Association for shelter, knowing it was on higher ground.
"You want to stay here or come with me?" Zaytoun asked.
Nasser knew that he would be safe at the campus, with little possibility of flooding or crime, but still he went with Zaytoun. He too wanted to see what had become of the city and of his home. He ran back into the building to get his duffel bag, and then stepped into the canoe. Zaytoun gave him the other paddle, and they were off. Nasser was 35 and tall, with freckles and a thick mess of red hair. He was quiet, with a slightly nervous demeanor. When Kathy met him, she thought he was a fragile sort of man. He was a sometime house painter, and had occasionally worked for Zaytoun. They weren't close friends, but running into Nasser here, after the flood, gave Zaytoun some comfort. They shared a lot of history. Syria, emigration to America and New Orleans, work in the trades. As they paddled, they talked about what they'd seen so far, what they'd been eating, how they'd been sleeping. Both men had heard the dogs barking, always the dogs barking at night. And Nasser, too, had fed dogs in the empty homes, on the streets, wherever he encountered them. It was one of the strangest aspects of this in-between time, after the storm but before anyone had returned to the city, the presence of these thousands of left-behind animals. The wind was stronger now. Fighting through an angry horizontal rain, they paddled by the post office near Jefferson Parkway and Lafitte. The parking lot there had become a staging ground for evacuations. Residents who wanted to be airlifted out of the city could come to the post office, and helicopters would take them, presumably, to safety. As they paddled closer, Zaytoun asked Nasser if he wanted to leave. "Not yet," Nasser said. He'd been hearing about the New Orleanians, stranded under highway overpasses, and he didn't want to be among them. Until he heard more reliable reports of successful evacuations, he would stay in the city. Zaytoun told him he was welcome to stay at the Dart House, or the house on Claiborne. He mentioned that there was a working phone on Claiborne, and this was a godsend to Nasser. He needed to call a half-dozen relatives to let them know he was alive. They paddled back to Claiborne, passing a full case of bottled water bobbing in the middle of the waterway. They lifted it into the canoe and continued on. When they arrived at the house, Nasser got out and began tying up the canoe. Zaytoun was stepping out when he heard a voice calling his name.
"Zaytoun!"
He figured it was Charlie Ray calling from next door. But it was coming from the house behind Charlie's, on Robert Street.
"Over here!"
It was the Williamses, a couple in their 70s. Alvin was a pastor at New Bethlehem Baptist Church and wheelchair-bound. Beulah was his wife of 45 years. Zaytoun and Kathy had known them for almost as long as they'd lived in New Orleans. When the Zaytouns had lived nearby, Pastor Williams's sister used to come to Kathy for meals. Kathy could never remember how it started, but the sister was elderly and liked Kathy's cooking. So around dinner time, Kathy always had a plate ready for her. It went on for months,
and it warmed Kathy to know someone would go to the trouble to eat what she'd made.
"Hello!" Zaytoun called out and paddled over. "You think you could help us get out of here?" Alvin asked.
The pastor and Beulah had waded out the storm, but had now exhausted their supply of food and water. Zaytoun had never seen them look so weary.
"It's time to go," Alvin said.
Given the rain and the wind, it was impossible to try to evacuate them in the canoe. Zaytoun told him he would find help. He paddled up Claiborne, the wind and rain fighting him, to the Memorial Medical Center, where he knew there were police and National Guard soldiers stationed. As he approached, he saw soldiers in the alleyway, on the roof, on the ramps and balconies. It looked like a heavily fortified military base. When he got close enough to see the faces of the soldiers, two of them raised their guns.
"Don't come any closer," they ordered.
Zaytoun slowed his canoe. The wind picked up. It was impossible to stay in one place, and making himself heard was difficult.
"I'm just looking for help," Zaytoun yelled.
One of the soldiers lowered his gun. The other kept his trained on Zaytoun.
"We can't help you," he said. "Go to St. Charles."
Zaytoun assumed the soldier hadn't heard him correctly. The wind was turning his canoe around, veiling his words.
"There's an old couple down the road that needs to be evacuated," he clarified, louder this time. "Not our problem," the soldier said. "Go to St. Charles."
Now both guns were lowered.
"Why not call somebody?" Zaytoun asked.
Did the soldier really mean that Zaytoun should paddle all the way to the intersection of Napoleon and St. Charles when the soldier could simply call another unit on his walkie-talkie? What were they doing in the city if not helping evacuate people?
"We can't call nobody," the other soldier said.
"How come?" Zaytoun asked. "With all this technology, you can't call someone."
Now the soldier, only a few years older than Zaytoun's son Zachary, seemed afraid. He had no answer, and seemed unsure of what to do next. Finally he turned and walked away. The remaining soldiers stared at Zaytoun, holding their M16s. Zaytoun turned his canoe around. He paddled to the intersection of Napoleon and St. Charles, his shoulders aching. The wind was making the work twice as difficult. The water grew shallow as he approached the intersection. He saw tents there, and military vehicles, and a dozen or so police officers and soldiers. He stepped out of his canoe and walked up to a man, a soldier of some kind, standing on the grassy median. New Orleanians called it the neutral ground.
"I have a situation," Zaytoun said. "I have a handicapped man who needs help, medical attention. He needs help now."
"Okay, we'll take care of it," the man said.
"Do you want the address?" Zaytoun asked.
"Yeah, sure, give me that,"
the man said, opening a small notebook. Zaytoun gave him the exact address. The man wrote it down and put his notebook back in his pocket.
"So you'll go?" Zaytoun asked.
"Yup,"
the man said.
"When?"
Zaytoun asked.
"About an hour," the man said.
"It's okay. They're on their way," Zaytoun said. "They said 1 hour."
The pastor and his wife thanked Zaytoun, and he returned to the Claiborne house. He picked up Nasser, and they set out to see what they could do. It was just after 1 o'clock. A 1,000 miles away, Yuko's husband Ahmed was driving the Odyssey. Kathy was resting, and the kids were in the back as they barreled through New Mexico. Ahmed had been at the wheel for 7 hours without a break. At this pace, they would make it to Phoenix by Saturday afternoon. Ahmed discouraged Kathy from listening to any news on the radio, but even on the rock and country stations, snippets of information were leaking through. President Bush was visiting New Orleans that day, and had just lamented the loss of Trent Lott's summer home in coastal Mississippi. Heavily armed National Guardsmen had just entered the convention center, and though they had been led to believe their entry would be met with something like guerrilla warfare, they had found no resistance whatsoever, only exhausted and hungry people who wanted to leave the city. Kathy took comfort in this, thinking that perhaps the city was coming under control. The military presence, one commentator was saying, would soon be overwhelming. Making their rounds, Zaytoun and Nasser found an abandoned military jeep, and in it, a box of meals, ready to eat, MREs. Shortly after, they encountered a family of five on an overpass, and gave them some water and the box of MREs. It was a tidy coincidence. Zaytoun didn't like to carry anything of value at all, and welcomed any opportunity to unload anything he'd found. It was about 5 o'clock, the sky darkening, when Zaytoun and Nasser made their way back to the Claiborne house. Zaytoun was sure that the pastor and his wife would have been rescued by that point, but just to be certain, he and Nasser made a detour, and paddled over to Robert Street. Alvin and Beulah were still there, on the porch, their bags still ready, a light rain still falling on them. They'd been waiting for 4 hours. Zaytoun was furious. He felt helpless, betrayed. He'd made a promise to the pastor and his wife, and because he'd been lied to, his promise hadn't been kept. He apologized to the couple, explaining that he had first tried the hospital, where he was sent away at gunpoint, and then gone to St. Charles to tell the soldiers and the relief workers about their plight. The pastor expressed confidence that help was still on its way, but Zaytoun didn't want to take any chances. "I'll figure something out," he said. When he and Nasser returned to the Claiborne house, they saw a small motorboat tied to the front porch. Inside the house, they found Todd Gambino sitting inside with a new dog. With the boat, which Todd had seen floating under a ruined garage and figured he would put to use, he'd been making his own rounds around the city, plucking people from porches and rooftops and bringing them to the overpasses and other points of rescue. He'd even found this dog, which was now happily eating food at Todd's feet, on a roof, and had taken him in. Again, Zaytoun felt the presence of some divine hand. The Williamses needed help immediately, help he hadn't been able to provide, and here was Todd, with precisely the vehicle they needed, at precisely the right moment. Todd didn't hesitate. Zaytoun agreed to care for the dog while he was gone, and Todd was off. He picked up Alvin and Beulah, cradling them one by one into the motorboat. Then he sped off toward the staging ground at Napoleon and St. Charles. The mission took all of 20 minutes. Soon, Todd was back, drinking a beer and relaxing again on the porch, his hands stroking the rescued dog's matted fur. "Some things you just have to do yourself," he said with a smile. Zaytoun had known Todd to be a good tenant, but he didn't know this side of him. They talked for a time on the porch, and Todd told him stories of his own rescues, how he'd picked up dozens of people already, how he'd been shuttling them to hospitals and staging grounds, how easy it was with a motorboat. Todd had always been, to Zaytoun's mind, a bit of a wanderer, something of a playboy. He liked to have a good time, didn't want to be too tied down with rules and responsibilities. He smoked, he drank, he kept irregular hours. But here he was, his eyes alight, talking about carrying people to safety, how his arrival at any given house or overpass was met with cheers and thanks. A time like this could change a man, Zaytoun knew, and he was happy to see it happening here and now to Todd. A good man made better. That night, Nasser came back with Zaytoun to the house on Dart. They removed the last of the lamb from the freezer and barbecued on the roof, recounting what they'd seen and what they'd heard. But Nasser was exhausted and faded quickly. He crawled into the tent and was soon fast asleep. Again, Zaytun was restless. He was still angry about the pastor and his wife. Nothing upset him more than someone breaking a promise. Who had that man been, at Napoleon and St. Charles, who had said he would send help to the Williams couple? Why had he said he would come, if he didn't plan to come? Zaytun tried to be generous. Perhaps he'd been pulled away to another emergency. Perhaps the man had gotten lost along the way. But it was no use. There was no excuse that could suffice. The man had abrogated a simple agreement. He'd promised help, and he had not kept that promise. Unable to sleep, Zaytun went back inside and sat on the floor of Nadima's room. Her smell, the smell of his girls, was faint now, replaced by rain and the beginnings of mildew. He missed them already. He couldn't think of more than a few times when he'd been apart from them this long. It was always like this. The first day alone afforded a welcome sense of calm and quiet, but slowly the missing would begin. He would miss their voices, their bright dark eyes, the rumble of their feet up and down the stairs, their squeals and constant singing. He opened one of the photo albums he'd saved and lay down on Nadima's bed, smelling her strawberry shampoo on the pillowcase. He found a picture from his first year at sea, aboard a ship captained by Ahmad. He marveled at his hair, so much of it then, and such vanity. He was about 30 pounds lighter then, a constant grin on his face, a man tasting the full feast of youth. His brother Ahmad had saved him, had opened to him worlds upon worlds. Ahmad left home a year after their father's death, traveling to Turkey to study medicine. This was the presumption in the house, at least. Though Mahmud had forbidden his sons from pursuing a life on the sea, Ahmad wanted nothing else. So he took a bus to Istanbul, telling his mother that his intention was to become a doctor. And for a while, he did study medicine. But soon, Ahmad left college and enrolled in a naval officer's training academy. When his mother learned Ahmad was to become a ship captain, she was surprised, but didn't stand in his way. 2 years later, Ahmad had graduated and was crisscrossing the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. Zaytun found one of Ahmad's photos. He had more pictures of Ahmad than he did of himself. It was almost comical how many photos his brother took and kept and distributed to family members. He documented every port, every ship. In this one, he and his crew were grilling something, some kind of animal. Zaytun stared at it. It looked like a greyhound. Could it be? No. Zaytun hoped it wasn't a dog. The banner above the men said Easter 1978. In another picture, Ahmad was standing in the middle of downtown New Orleans. When he saw this photo, and so many others, of Ahmad standing in front of this city or that monument, Zaytun always thought of the people Ahmad had asked to take the pictures. Ahmad must have met 1,000 people during these trips, chiefly in the pursuit of someone to help him document that Ahmad Zaytun of Jable, Syria, was here. Here in Tokyo, here in America, here in India. While Ahmad was seeing every corner of the world in rapid succession, Zaytun was back home in Jable, and he wanted out. It was a hollow home, and Zaytun couldn't stand it. During the days he worked at his brother Lutfi's construction materials store, hearing the stories of Ahmad's continuing adventures, his trips to China, Australia, South Africa, Holland. Zaytun knew his father wouldn't have approved when he was alive, but he was gone now. And Muhammad was gone, too. Zaytun didn't want to be stuck in Jable. His mother knew his feelings. She'd heard him pace back and forth on the second floor, had seen his eyes' longing look when he'd talked to Ahmad on the phone. So on her own accord, she called Ahmad one day and asked him to take his younger brother with him. It was time, she said, for Abdul Rahman to leave Jable and get away, if only for a spell, from their home so full of melancholy. Ahmed called his younger brother and told him he'd be shipping out in a few weeks' time. Zaytun was speechless. He kissed the phone. He kissed his mother and sisters. And when the time came, he gathered a sack full of things and met Ahmed in Greece. On his first voyage, he was a deckhand, the youngest man on board. The other crew members hailed from everywhere, South Africa, Turkey, Nigeria, and welcomed him warmly. Zaytun was convinced Ahmed was treating him a bit more roughly than the others, to compensate for any suspicions of nepotism, but he didn't mind. He washed and painted and hauled. He did the jobs no one wanted to do. They sailed from Piraeus to Naxos and back, and Zaytun was in love with it all. He let his hair grow. He spent his free time on deck, looking out, watching the water come at the ship and disappear behind it. Though the schedule was grueling, 4 hours on and four off, all day and night, he didn't mind. He didn't need to sleep, not yet. He hadn't known until then how badly he'd needed this kind of freedom. He felt twice as strong, three times as tall. And finally Zaytun knew Ahmed's secret, why he'd become a sailor, why he'd risked so much to become a captain. As they passed on deck or on their way to their different quarters, Zaytun and Ahmed shared knowing glances, sheepish smiles. Only now did Zaytun know liberation, and it was everything. Ahmed could see that his younger brother wouldn't be returning to Jable anytime soon. Their lives were at sea, together and apart, as they passed from their 20s to their early 30s. There were cargo ships, passenger ships, combinations of both. They brought Nebraskan wheat to Tokyo, Brazilian bananas to London, American scrap metal to India. They brought Romanian cement to Nigeria. And always in Nigeria, there were stowaways. Every time they left Lagos, they could count on finding two or three men hiding. And always they made the same arrangement. Earn your keep on board, and when we reach the next port, you're on your own. Jobs on general cargo ships were prized most. They usually spent a week or two at port, giving the crew plenty of time to investigate the area. Zaytun explored dozens of cities, always docking with a pocketful of money and no obligations to anyone. He would rent a car, devour the surrounding towns, explore the coast, visit famed mosques, meet women who would beg him to stay. But he was a serious young man, perhaps too serious at times. It was no secret that seamen liked to play cards and enjoy a drink or two. Zaytun didn't gamble and had never had a drop of alcohol, so when his own shifts were over, he went back to work, helping whoever needed it. And when there wasn't work to do, while his crewmates got stoned and took each other's money playing cards, he found a different diversion. He would go to the small pool on board the ship and tie a rope around his waist. He would tie the other end to the wall, and then he would swim, 3 hours at a stretch, strengthening his arms and back, testing himself. He was always testing himself, seeing how much his body could do. In the end, Zaytun spent 10 years as a sailor. Aboard a ship called a Starcaster, he saw the Persian Gulf, Japan, Australia, and Baltimore. Aboard the Captain Elias, he saw Holland and Norway. He saw herds of humpbacks, breaching gray whales, schools of dolphins leading the ships to port. He saw the Aurora Borealis, meteor showers over tumbling black waves, night skies so clear the stars seemed within reach, hung from a ceiling by fishing wire. He served on the Nitsa, the Andromeda. He sailed all the way until